Essayist and novelist Kiese Layman's new book, Heavy, an American Memoir, is an exploration of what the weight of a lifetime of secrets, lies, and deception does to a black body, a black family, and a nation teetering on the brink of moral collapse. Kiese Layman is a black Southern writer born and raised in Jackson, Mississippi. His books include the novel Long Division and a collection of essays, How to Slowly Kill Yourself and Others in America. The new book is Heavy, an American Memoir. It is published by Scribner, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Kiese Layman to the roundtable this morning. Kiese, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
So what brought you to want to write this memoir and to write ultimately about the topics that you write about?
I always wanted to write this memoir. I think I tried to write it at 12 years old, but there wasn't anybody around me who would really read what I wrote. So, you know, I just needed to try to make sense of a lot of the things I saw that my family never talked about. And I had to write two other books, I think, to hone my skills to get to a place where I had enough, like, audacity to try to write into, like, the cracks of my experience with my mother, my experience with my state, my experience with my country.
The state being Mississippi, the town being Jackson, you grew up in this, in a rural community?
No, I grew up in urban southern community and a rural southern community in Forest, Mississippi. So I went back and forth. My grandmother lived in a rural black southern town called Forest. I stayed with her sometimes, and my mom lived in Jackson, which is the capital of Mississippi.
It is a painful relationship with your mother. Talk a little bit about that and ultimately what you wanted to explore.
Yeah, my mom had me when she was a sophomore in college, and, you know, she was really obsessed with reading and writing, and I needed to write this book, one, to thank her for teaching me how to read and write, and two, I just needed to use what she taught me to take a look at, like, the conversations we never had. She, like a lot of parents in this country, you know, especially new parents, like, she didn't really know what she was doing. So I saw her fail in ways she didn't know I saw, but she also saw me fail in ways that I didn't think she saw either. So I just wanted to write a book that attempted to open up like healthy lines of communication for us and then hope that other people would find something similar in their relationships with their parents or their children.
How understanding in the sense of your understanding of what happened and the context of your growing up and of your relationship, how much understanding did you have to be able to write about it and to explore it?
Not much. I mean, I use writing for discovery. Like, I wrote about it because I did not understand it. Yeah, I mean, I wrote not to express what I understood, but I wrote about it because I did not understand. I didn't understand my mom's relationship to her partner. I didn't understand how really that relationship impacted us. I didn't understand how my state's investment in particular kinds of terror infected our relationships. I didn't understand any of that, so I had to write it all out in order to start to understand. And I still don't completely understand, but I'm better than I was when I started a long time ago, for sure.
Your mother is a professor of political science, and ultimately you point out that there was a teaching that lying is just something you do to survive.
Yeah, I mean, but the thing is, my mom taught me that, but the nation taught her that, right?
Right.
I think that's what's interesting. I mean, we have a president who believes the same thing, you know, whatever it takes to survive, you do it. And my mother, she really had reason to believe that you don't show who you are to people who don't have your best interest at heart, because we'd seen familiarly what happened with that in our family, and, you know, she saw a lot of what happened with that in her life, and she worried about that with me. So she was just like, you know, when you leave out of this house, you don't have to show anybody the real you. You just have to make it back into the house tonight. And I understand that, but, you know, I'm a writer, I'm an artist, and I wanted to think and talk about what the consequence sometimes of living that kind of life is.
In writing this book, you refer to your mother as you, right? I mean, you're writing this almost to her.
Right.
was that a decision, obviously a conscious decision, that came early in the process?
No, it came right around the middle of the process. I initially was trying to write another book where I was interviewing my mom and my grandmama about their relationships to food and sexual violence, and I did all the interviews for that, and I wrote that book. And then I just realized that, like, I wasn't really in that book, and I wasn't answering any of the questions I was asking them. So I decided to write it to my grandmother, to my mom, to my imaginary daughter, and to one of my ex-partners. And then after I did that, I was like, okay, the hardest chapter to write is the chapter to my mom, and that's really probably what I need to do with the whole book. So then I rewrote it again, and, you know, I just took a lot of revisions. And then near the end, I was just like, this is a conversation between my mother and me. And so I just need to just, you know, have the courage to try to pull it off. And I had never seen it done, which made it harder. But, I didn't get it all the way right, but I got close.
It's hard to see how you didn't get it right, but you would know that obviously better than anyone else. But I look at this, and you say at one point in writing about the abuse that you suffered at the hands of your mother, that this was basically, she did this for, you say, for not being perfect.
Yeah, again, my mom, you grew up in central Mississippi and rural Mississippi and urban Mississippi, in the nation, you know, especially if you have a black child, you just see what, you know, schools do to your child, what neighborhoods or police do to your child. So my mama had this belief that, like, if somehow I could make myself perfect or present in a perfect way, that I could protect myself and survive. And, you know, I didn't agree with that back when I was a kid. And so when I got older and got opportunity to write about it, I just wanted to talk to her about how, like, you know, demanding perfection from any child, and particularly from black children, is not the way we're going to get liberated or get free. You know what I mean? I think we need to exactly do the opposite, which is expect health and healthy decisions, but also ask ourselves, have we done enough to make children, you know, make good decisions as a country and make and be healthy? And I think that's much more important than, like, trying to get kids to strive for perfection, because that's just, you know, it's impossible, right? Especially, it's just impossible.
As an eighth grader, you point out you weigh 231 pounds, and the name of the book is Heavy. So your weight and the weight of that is something that you very much explore in the book.
Yeah, but, you know, and so I wanted the book to not run away from, like, bodily weight, but I also just didn't want the book to just be about bodily weight, right? Like, how much we weigh. I wanted to actually think about what was going on in my life before and after I weighed myself, what I thought, what I felt in terms of, like, insecurity. Sometimes I felt euphoric. And also just wanted to think about, like, you know, again, like, as a child, like, I was taught that resolutions or, you know, numbers, if you can reach a particular number, if you're losing weight, like, that was success. And I really just want the reader and my mom and me to think about how, like, these sort of deliverances are always short-lived, whether they're like, you know, I want to lose 15 pounds, or I want to gain 30 pounds, or, you know, I want to have this conversation with my mom, and after I have one, I feel like I've done all the work. You know, I just think the work is perpetual, but I don't think much in our culture encourages us to understand that. So the weight loss and the weight gain in the book is some way an easy way for the reader to make sense of what's happening with my body, but also with the nation that cradles my body.
There is the weight gain and the weight loss that you read about, and that struggle, but also with gambling as well, something that starts with your mother and then goes to you as well. And in some way, there's still that addictive behavior that is at the heart of what's happening to you.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, and you know, I picked up gambling after I'd run myself into the ground, like after I couldn't run anymore. It's ironic because, you know, I'd been in casinos my entire life and never really wanted to gamble. Like, I liked being in casinos, watching my family gamble, or walking through casinos with my partners or something, but I didn't really become obsessed with it until my body broke. And I realized early in that process that I wasn't really going to the casino to win. I was actually going to lose. And, you know, losing felt in this strange way terrible, but also it just gave me a rush. You know, winning gave me a rush too, but at the casino, you know, once you lose a certain amount of money, you're never going to win it back. You can just chase and chase and chase, and chasing, you're going to lose. You're going to eventually lose because you always think you can win it back and you really can't. So, yeah, I picked that up later on in my life, and writing this book more than anything actually helped me confront my addiction to casinos and my addiction to gambling, and really helped me save some money these last few years, because I just don't have that same relationship to casinos anymore after writing about them.
You write about your peers in the book. There's a line where you say, "I was taught by big boys who were taught by big boys who were taught by big boys that black girls would be okay no matter what we did to them." When do you realize what is happening there is not right?
I mean, honestly, I realized, you know, I didn't know what to call that until I got to college, and then I learned that actually is what patriarchy is. But there was something in me that knew early on that the way we were encouraged to talk to and treat black girls, because those were the girls in our neighborhood, it wasn't right. It wasn't, you know, none of us would have wanted to be treated that way. So I, you know, that's the thing I'm trying to say in that book. Like, in some ways, sometimes I didn't understand right from wrong, but often I understood, even with the lessons I was taught, I understood right from wrong. And sometimes I just chose wrong. And I just think that's something we need to think about as Americans, right? Sometimes it's about ignorance, but often it's about informed neglect. Like, we know right from wrong often, and we choose to do what's most harmful to ourselves, but also what's most harmful to the most vulnerable people. And as a child, I didn't have a language to wrap around what we were doing, but, you know, I knew what was being done. You know, a lot of times those boys were making us fight in order to go swimming. I knew that was wrong, but, you know, I wanted to go swimming. And they would do things to girls that were just absolutely horrible. I didn't know exactly what was happening, but I knew that they wouldn't want being done to them what was being done to girls, you know. But, again, we were just taught that it was all okay. And that particularly with black girls, it would be okay because they would recover. I just don't think that's true.
Your mother would have had a student that would babysit you, and ultimately you were the victim of sexual abuse. Did you feel that to be, did you know the right and the wrong of that right away?
Nah, I didn't. I mean, I thought that was my girlfriend. You know what I'm saying? Like, she
right.
was 21 and or something. I was like 9. And the first time it happened, I thought it was my girlfriend. And then, I knew it was wrong enough not to tell anybody. I knew I couldn't tell my mom. I knew I couldn't tell anybody else what was happening. But it also felt like, parts of it felt like bodily great. And then it felt like dying, you know? And especially when I saw her with her actual boyfriend and what he was doing to her. Like, so I knew that was more than wrong, but I just did not know how to talk to anybody about it. You know, I literally didn't know how to begin sentences. Like, what would I say? You know, like, she did this, we did this, I saw this. I didn't even know how to talk about it. And sadly, it took me like 30 years to be able to really try to write into it, but I didn't know how. I had a feeling it was wrong, but I didn't know how to talk about it.
There's times in the book where you get a sense where things are getting better, and then but you just sort of stop, and I guess we never really know that, right, of what better is.
Yeah, I don't know if we know what better is. I think we know what work is, and what I'm trying to say at the end of that book is that I think we're always looking for resolution. I and my family, we're always looking for progress, for resolution, instead of looking for just investments in, like, the work of being healthy. And so I'm trying to say by the end of that book, you know, there's not going to be any false resolutions here, right? Like, we are here. We could become worse if we don't work on it. We also could become better. You know, we will decide that when this book closes. You know, I think we as a nation will decide it, and I think my mother and I will decide it. And I just did not want to offer, like, this false sort of ending where we're all good and hunky-dory. You know, like, every day is work. Every day we can become worse as people, as Americans, as Mississippians. And every day we can become better and honest and loving. And it's all mixed up, you know. And some days are worse than others. And so I just wanted the nation and my mama to know, like, I'm ready to work. If you're ready to work, let's work.
Right.
Let's work.
I mean, you make that point of that you wanted to write a why, that your mother wanted to read a why. And I guess that goes for all of us, right? We all, I guess, it's easier to go for the lie.
I know I do. I know I want to read the lie. I want to wake up right now and turn on the TV and, you know, hear that the poorest people in the nation actually are okay being poor. And, you know, like, the homeless population out there, and it's actually a lot smaller than we think. You know, I want to read all the lies, but... You know, why? Like, that's the question. Why do I want to read a lie? What am I doing to make the world become less obsessed with deception? That is the question I'm trying to ask myself in that book.
You mentioned very early in our conversation about linking these lies, and you talked about the president said that, you know, you do this for survival, but also in his case, it's to win. And I guess it's knowing what that of that, what winning is, and ultimately that key or that relationship between winning, if you will, or survival, and the difference between that of how we feel personally because of what we've done, or how we feel that we have done, is much different than how it affects other people.
Oh yeah, absolutely, man. I mean, you know, the great thing about the Trump presidency is, like, it's putting all of the American things that, like, writers have been writing about and critiquing about our country, like, up front and center. Like, all that shit is glowy. You know, it's glowy right now. You look at what this he doesn't want the country to win. He wants to win, right? Which,
right.
And he makes no bones about it, right? Like, that's what's so interesting. Like, he's not even acting like he wants the most vulnerable people in this country to actually be healthy and cared for. Like, he wants to win. And the majority of white voters in this country, I want to vote for that kind of person, which says a lot, you know? Says way more than I think what we're actually willing to say. And so, yeah, some of us are out here trying to survive. And then other people, I think, are watching this actual president try to win. But what is winning for, you know, like, I saw, if I was his friend, I'd be like, what is winning for you, man? You're presumably a 70-year-old multimillionaire. Sit down and watch Wheel of Fortune for the rest of your life. That sounds like winning to me, you know? That's what I would tell him. This is not winning, brother. Like, sitting up in front of people and lying every day and looking all, like, beat down, and that's not winning. I wish I was his friend, man. I'd put some house shoes on that dude and put him in a nice recliner, and he would just be watching Passe Jack all day. all of that.
And but also the empathy. I mean, that seems to be what's lacking is sure the winning, but as you say, the empathy that you have for the other people who don't have what he has, and the empathy for the people that what you're saying, how it impacts them, how it impacted you, how it impacted your growing up, and the of having any understanding of the other.
Right. None. I mean, and the people who made him don't want to see that in him, right? Like, that's what's, again, like, the thing about, I don't mean, this conversation wasn't about Trump, but the thing about Trump is that it's not even about Trump. Like, Trump did not, I mean, I think he got help, but he didn't make himself president, you know? Like, somebody, like, we as a nation decided that guy's going to be the next president. And as much as I like to see these conversations about Trump, I think we lose sight of, like, what it means that Americans who are sometimes fighting to survive, fighting to survive, want to punish other people by making this guy president. And that's the truth. Like, you know, like, some people believe that Mexicans, Muslims, black folk, quote-unquote nasty women would all be punished by this president, so they voted for him. But why? Like, what about American and American education systems and familial systems and religious systems encourage a particular part of our nation to want this guy to punish people as a form of winning? That's the question. But I don't think we want to sit in the answer, you know.
I think you're absolutely right. And the other thing, too, is that a lot of this is backed with some religious base that you think would be the opposite of wanting people to suffer.
Right. Until you look at the way Christianity's operated and for most of American history, and you know, I grew up a Christian, and Christianity to some degree saved my family. A radical kind of Christianity, but you know, you look through, I mean, post 9/11, like that was a Christian war we waged on people who kind of didn't have anything to do with the towers coming down. You know what I mean? Like, George Bush wanted everybody to know this is a Christian war. Like, God bless America. You know? Forget these millions or hundreds of thousands of Iraqis that we're killing. God bless America. So I'm saying that my point is that, like, Trump doesn't come out of nowhere. Like, you know, our policies, our precedents set, like, precedents, like, actually make this dude possible. But what I'm saying in that book is what happens if we actually slow it all down and actually talk about the stuff we don't want to talk about, not just with people who disagree with us, which is what the nation is obsessed with now, but like, why not, what can we talk about how we actually fail at loving the people and the policies we actually do agree with?
Right.
That's what's interesting to me, because I don't think Trump loves America. There's no proof that he loves America. Right? There was no proof in different parts of my relationship with my mom that my mother and I loved each other. So let's talk about how we fail at loving the things we purport to love, not just how we fail at loving people who are on other sides of the aisle. We can get to that, but we got to get to this other thing first, and that's what that book is really about.
I mean, you said to me early on in this conversation when you were talking about how you feel and ultimately that you wanted to explore these things to figure it out, and yet you're still figuring it out. There's still some things that you still need to figure out. So where does that leave you now? Is there a happiness and an understanding, or is that something that's not attainable?
I mean, there's just an acceptance of work, brother. Like, that's the truth. There's an acceptance, and sometimes that acceptance feels joyful, and other times that acceptance feels like a burden. But there's an acceptance that every day I wake up, if I'm lucky enough to wake up, I have to work to be better at being a person I want to be. I have to work at being a loving partner, a loving son, a loving, like, citizen, a loving teacher. And if I don't work really hard at it, I'm going to fail, and people are going to suffer. And so every day, and some days I fail. Most days I might fail, but I just accept that every day it's going to be work to get good at the things that I say I care about. So there is no deliverance for me. There's just the acceptance that it's work.
The name of the book is Heavy, an American Memoir. Kiese Lehman, I thank you very much for sharing with us this morning. A great pleasure to have you on our program.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much. Again, the name of the book is Heavy. It is published by Scribner. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.